Portfolio Committee on International Relations and Cooperation. With me are members of the Portfolio Committee, members of Parliament, members of the Portfolio Committee, our staff and guests that we have. Let me take the opportunity to welcome all of you, once again, all of the members and our guests. Let me also give a special word of welcome to our guests here. Let me start with His Excellency, the Ambassador, Ambassador Carlos Hernandez de Cosi. Welcome, sir, and welcome to South Africa as well. We are aware that you are the newly appointed ambassador of the Cuban embassy. We've got together with the former ambassador who was here, and of course we were able to, or we're fortunate to have met your charge d'affaires, Ambassador Oliver, who made a presentation to the committee a couple of weeks ago. Let me also welcome Mr. Christopher Matlaku, the Secretary General of the Friends of Cuba Society. Welcome so much. Now, may I just say as well that Mr. Matlaku, I had to remind him a couple of minutes ago that we actually from the same province. We met somewhere in the 90s during the liberation struggle. We were both activists then, and Comrade Matlaku was my leader at the time. He has always served on our provincial structures, notably the parties in particular. Then with us as well, we have, of course, welcomed Ms. Matlaku. Then we also have the Chief Director, Ambassador Fenton. He is the Chief Director for the Americas. He will also be making the presentation today. Now, so, honorable members, may I take a minute or two to remind you that a couple of weeks ago, in fact, to be precise, on the 5th of June, we had an engagement as a committee with the Department of International Relations. And we also had a presentation from the Charge d'Affaires from the Embassy of Cuba, who gave us presentations on the state of bilateral relations between the two countries. Now, this matter actually was carried over from our agenda last year already, or the year before, if I'm not mistaken, when we had resolved then that we wanted to take a deeper look into Cuba as a relations, precisely because Cuba is such an important partner for South Africa, both historically, but also in the context of the current bilateral and multilateral processes. At some point, there was an outcry about the so-called writing off of debts that the South African did some years ago, I think it was 2 years ago or so. Some felt that it was a waste of time, it was a waste of money, and that was irresponsible on the part of the African government. Of course, there was another view that said, look, these are the conditions under which the debt was written off, and South Africa had a responsibility to do so, especially because it owes so much in patriotism. It owes so much to Cuba and the people of Cuba. Now, of course, as I said, Cuba was one of South Africa's greatest partners. in a political, well, perhaps let me start to say, both historically, in terms of our nation spending a couple of decades during the liberation struggle. Relations were, of course, underpinned by those historical ties, which were forged in the common struggle against apartheid and colonialism. Now, perhaps if we backtrack a bit, perhaps let me state that these relations were forged pre-1994, during the liberation struggle, through, among others, through providing support for South African students. It gave military, political support, and of course it gave material support for our struggle. Now, let people get, honorable members, that one of the battles that arguably brought about our own liberation was what famously became known as the Battle of Itakanawa, which forced the South African government to the negotiating table, which of course led to the declaration or adoption of Resolution 45 by the United Nations Security Council, paving the way for the independence of Namibia, and thus signaling the collapse of the apartheid government, and of course paving the way for our own freedom. So this battle was decisive, and in fact today we have the singular honor to have the ambassador who happened to have been one of the Cuban soldiers in the trenches at the Battle of Kitakanawala. Now, subsequently, after the attainment of our own freedom, official bilateral relations were established between the two countries. On 11 May 1994, Cuba and South Africa established full diplomatic relations, and our government undertook, but both governments actually undertook to foster trade, economic, cultural, and sporting ties, which is with each other, turned out to be mutually beneficial. Now, both governments, of course, share similar interests in relation to addressing the social and economic aspirations of both the people of South Africa and Cuba. And in this regard, a number of bilateral cooperation agreements were signed, ranging from, science to technology, agriculture, sports, recreation, air facilities, air services, mission, shipping, trade, and broadly economic assistance. Now, our own government has attempted to tackle skill shortages in South Africa by employing some foreign skilled workers. Now, in this regard, a program involving about 450 Cuban professionals is one of the examples of this. You will recall, honorable members, that in fact, Cuban doctors arrived in South Africa in 1996. Their primary aim was to fill the medical skill shortages that we had in our country. And these doctors were assigned to mainly work in your rural areas, urban and very urban areas in an attempt to address these shortages. And in fact, today, still, there are Cuban doctors all over our South African hospitals. In fact, in my own town, the head of the, apart from other Cuban doctors that are there in the hospital, but in my own town, the head of the HIV AIDS unit there happens to be a Cuban doctor. So part of it also was to share experiences with our South African compatriots and assist us in the training of medical doctors and more broadly on the delivery of quality medical care. In 2010, Cabinet approved economic and economic assistance package to Cuba to strengthen bilateral trade and investment and assist in addressing efforts such as natural disasters. Now, during his state visit to Cuba in December 2010, President Zuma announced what government called an economic assistance agreement or economic assistance package, which of course was signed on the 3rd of February 2012. We have also learned that there are still challenges towards the actual ratification and implementation of the agreement, and hope to hear some of those challenges today. We have noticed that, of course, the funding for this package would also come from the African Renaissance Fund. We are also aware, honorable members, that on the issue of trade, Cuba is experiencing difficulties in that regard, and in particular on foreign exchange, the foreign exchange constraints. We noted as well that Cuba has, among others, at least in 2008, suffered from a devastating hurricane during the hurricane season, damaging a lot of infrastructure. Now, this problem, especially pertaining to recovery, was in fact compounded by the trade and economic embargo imposed upon the island nation. Now, we had, as you know, we've gone out of our way, I would say, to invite our American counterparts to give us their view on this matter. They haven't been forthcoming, nor in the committee. We are here. They were invited here to be here today. They've respectfully declined. Now, so you will recall we had quite an extensive discussion in the committee about trying to involve them so that we hear what they have to say, so that other people don't speak on their behalf. We've made our efforts, Mr. Secretary. We've made our efforts. In fact, there was an engagement between them and the administration. Tried to reach over the backwards because initially they took offense with the theme of today's meeting, and they asked us to tone the thing a bit down, you know, to make it possible for them to be. We did that, toned the thing down a bit, because really it wasn't about the thing, it was about in trying to involve everyone. Well, in fact, I think just the following day, if I'm not mistaken, after we've gone through this exercise, they declined anyway. Now, I said, when I spoke to one of them, I said, see, the danger always is if you don't reach and state your point of view, ask people to speak on and your voice will not be heard. But what you cannot do either is to hold Parliament's own processes to ransom. Because people don't want to participate in a dialogue about issues which concern them. We have also raised the matter of the Cuban Bush. Now, they insist only three left in jail. We know there's four left in jail. The one, I think it's Hernandez, the one I was talking about. Yeah, but one of them released, I think, also last year, around that time. He's back in Cuba, as far as we know. But the campaign still is called the Cuban Five. They were initial five. So, of course, our understanding is that they don't want to engage on this issue of Cuba. And so that's unfortunate. However, we have to conclude our inquiry and plot a way forward to the committee in terms of how we want to deal with the matter. Both on this and, of course, on the matters of bilateral relations between our two countries. Lastly, honourable members, I want to request that we engage, because really the intent of this, or the purpose of this garden, is to help us gain as much information as we can to be able to recommend a way forward, and we hope we will succeed in doing that. I have no doubt that we will be able to. We will, in fact, do exactly that. And hopefully, we should conclude this matter in the following 2 weeks or so, so that we attend to other matters on the point of action. Thank you so much. Let me use the opportunity to ask the Chief Director of the DIRC, Ambassador Feather, to give his presentation. Thanks.
Honorable Chair of the Portfolio Committee and members, Your Excellency the Cuban Ambassador, Ambassador Fernandez, the Secretary General of the Friends of Cuba Society, Ms. McClatton. Chair, you make it very easy because in your introduction you've covered a lot of the elements that make up our relationship. And when we talk about Cuba, obviously, the role that Cuba played before 1994 is central to so many things that happened in South Africa, and for which South Africa is very thankful for the support, which was over a very wide array of fields. The ambassador, just when I met him now half an hour ago, mentioned to me that last Saturday he arranged a gathering for people, students that studied in Cuba in the 1980s, etc. They got together and all were speaking Spanish, etc. And I think it's also a very good testimony of the importance that everybody has for this very close relationship. If we look at what happened after 1994, Cuba was one of the first countries to offer material and human resource support to South Africa. The success of South Africa's political, bilateral, and multilateral relations could therefore be measured in the extent of the numerous development programs, cooperation projects, as well as the strong political and social solidarity and support that exists between our countries. And I will lift out a few of the issues that the chairman has also alluded to. Since 1994, and I'm not going to go into that detail, but there have been so many high-level interactions. But for the purposes of today, I would like to really start with a state visit to Cuba by President Zuma that was also alluded to in December 2010, which I think was a major development, and it enhanced our relationships. Cuba, as mentioned, is a key partner, and its foreign policy objectives and those of our domestic priorities are very, very similar. As a result, South Africa's bilateral relations with Cuba are aligned in several key strategic priorities. Various bilateral agreements in fields of science and technology, and this has also been alluded to, have been signed. And I dare say that the purpose of today's meeting is really possibly, Chair, to say we've got the agreements, but what has happened? How do we give substance to that? And today we're talking about the economic and commercial side. But if we can use the example of the success of South Africa's being a beneficiary of Cuba's ongoing assistance in the form of scholarships for our youth, I would like to mention that currently we have close to 1,400 South African students studying medicine in Cuban universities. A total of 323 South African graduates from Cuba work as medical doctors in various South African hospitals. More importantly, in 2012, South Africa and Cuba extended this agreement in the fields of health and medical science that will lead to an increased number of medical students that will study in Cuba and thereby contribute to the implementation of the health insurance, the national health insurance. I can also mention that because of this real big growing number of students that we have in Cuba, the National Department of Health has decided to appoint a health attaché to our embassy in Havana, which is a medical doctor that actually studies in Cuba, speaks the language, and I think that's going to be of great assistance to us in managing this vast number of students that are not all in the same area or location spread over different campuses. There's also a considerable number of Cuban skilled people that are helping us. The chair referred to the doctors, but we have engineers and we have academic staff, which I think we are trying to manage as well. I'm aware that there was a meeting with Home Affairs, etc., and all the different departments to see how we can streamline this process, because we need them in public works and some of the other departments. In 2008, South African government, working with civil society, pledged humanitarian aid to the government of Cuba in the wake of a severe destruction and damage caused by three successive hurricanes. And I think this was also the people-to-people element getting involved. In 2010, South Africa announced cancellation of Cuba's $1 billion debt that was referred to by the chair, and this paved the way for enhanced trade and commercial relations, which could be seized upon by the economic actors in the respective countries. But I dare say since 2010, if you look at the actual trade figures, they are really very small, and I will get to that a little later. In 2012, an agreement on economic assistance to Cuba was signed. The amount was $350 million, and this comprised of $100 million, which was termed as a solidarity grant, $40 million rand as a grant for the purchase of seeds, of which $5 million would be procured in South Africa, mainly onion and sunflower seed, and the other 35 million for purchases elsewhere that were identified by Cuba. Additionally, a 70 million rand credit line facility underwritten by the Export Credit Insurance Corporation to provide risk cover to potential South African exporters to Cuba. And lastly, 140 million second tranche of export guarantee underwritten by the ETIC, which will become available based on the payment of the initial 70. The assistance package is advanced. It was mentioned that initially we had a few, I wouldn't say hiccups, but because there were so many role players in this. DIRCO, the Department of International Relations and Cooperation, through the African Renaissance Fund, would facilitate the 100 million solidarity grant. The Department of Agriculture, Forests and Fisheries would attend to the management of the seed needs that I mentioned. DGI essentially was the government department that signed the agreement. And the IDC, the Industrial Development Corporation, has now been appointed as the state agent. Now, why I'm saying the state agent, because some of the technicalities that we ran into was the issue of identifying banks to do the transactions, bearing in mind that you've got to take certain third countries' legislation into account, etc., and became a little complicated. It seems to me, and what I've heard lately, is that that has now been unlocked and that there will be a movement on this project. I think that this economic assistance package should be seen together with the two other structures that we have established. The one is at ministerial level, we have the South Africa-Cuba Joint Bilateral Commission. And that has been in place since 2001. This is at ministerial level, and it's really to review and steer the relationship that we have in the different fields, whether it's economic, scientific, technical, etc. I think more active committee is the joint consultative mechanism that is run at deputy ministerial level that takes place once a year, and the 10th meeting will take place. This was established by the year 2000. The 10th meeting will take place in Havana in September this year. And I think with these coordination mechanisms, together now with this economic package, which will underpin certain initiatives, hopefully that's going to help us to make progress, especially in the commercial field. If we look at the trade side, we have to accept that the Cuban market, and which is relatively small, as well as the logistics distance, have a dampening effect on the trade. And it's also a situation of a chicken and egg situation, where if the trade is there, the bishops and the aeroplanes will follow. On the other hand, if the ships and the aeroplanes were there, then the trade would follow. The economic package now starts laying the foundation to further develop this. In other words, there is an incentive for us to really engage and use this instrument that has been created. During recent engagements between the South African Embassy in Havana and the Cuban Chamber of Commerce, they have been exploring possible sectors for business opportunities and investments in Cuba. In other words, what we want to try and do is try and give content to the possibilities that have been unlocked, or in the process of being unlocked by this economic assistance package. Cuban priority sectors include energy, oil, mining, and tourism. And these are not exhaustive. You could add to that textile, aerospace, rail, and marine. And I think the message that we received is, do not limit yourself to any particular sector. What is interesting is if we also look at other role players. The Canadians are quite involved in energy and oil sector. And I mentioned tourism. The information that I have is that you now already have 2.5 million tourists that are visiting Cuba annually, and therefore there's a real need for investments in the hospitality industry, particularly hotels, in that type of infrastructure. And if we have the need and upgrade and new hotels, etc., then obviously it becomes important that you in turn will need furniture, linen, equipment for the kitchens, etc. So there's a whole multiplier effect that the trade, the tourism industry could create. It has also been noted that there are a number of Cuban manufacturers that are looking at the possibility of engaging in Italia, South Africa, on packaging in order to increase their regional and global marketing. Another sector that was identified was mining and construction vehicles. Call it the domestic vehicle market, which South Africa is very big in exporting, has been taken care of by other countries who have engaged Cuba, and therefore we should try and find a niche, and we are very strong on the mining equipment side. The DTI will participate this year again in the Havana Trade Fair in October, and that we hope that their identification of participants that will go to Havana for this trade fair could be linked and could be supported through the economic package. The challenges that one would have is that there is no structure where there's business to business or government to business coordination. One of the things that we are putting up is that people go on visits, they engage people, and then they never hear of them again. And I think we might try and set up a structure where we can try and manage and assist with this. So it is very important that government and business coordinate their efforts in order to grow the trade. I mentioned the distance, the logistics, which is a problem. And then the US legislation that you've got to bear in mind when you are dealing and the logistics of getting products there, etc. But I don't want to go into much detail on that. The opportunities that we have identified means if you look at the Caribbean market, they in need of a hub. And if you look at the, and I'm using this as an example, but the Brazilians are heavily investing in a port called, is it Mariela? Mariana. Now, if that infrastructure is unlocked, together with the air connections that Cuba has in the region, it can very easily become a very serious hub from which you can then reach other markets, and those other markets then boost the volume, if I can call it that, and then just makes it more interesting for people, and not to say, but it's small, far away, etc. I think you've got to also bear in mind that Cuba is one of the countries that has an excellent and skilled workforce, and surely for anybody who wants to invest, etc., this is a big plus point, and I think this is something that should be marketed. We mentioned the hospitality in the hotels. I am reminded some 12, 15 years ago, we did a study when we looked at the North African countries and the bed nights, how many tourists they got. And then we started working out how many towels they need, how many new sheets they need, how many new mattresses they need, etc. And it becomes a huge economy all on its own. And if you are talking about, I believe there's a Spanish group, Melia, who already have more than 100 hotels now. And this is a growing industry with huge employment opportunities. Then I think we should really go and have a look at what the opportunities are and not only on an ad hoc basis. I think at the end of the day, what I would identify as the major thing we should do now is to try and coordinate our efforts. We have got the assistance package that is now becoming available. Obviously, this is a partnership, but we've got to try and open up the opportunities for people. And as we go along, we will find that nothing succeeds like success. We are working already in the pharmaceutical field, but I think there are many other sectors that we can look at. It's probably going to be more South Africa to Cuba, but I think Cuba could be a fantastic gateway to that region, which we should look at. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Ambassador. Okay, what we'll do is we'll have all the presentations first, and then we can engage with all of them at once. I summarize that by the time we have the third presentation, it should be about lunch. We'll then have lunch after lunch engage. Okay. It's your podium.
Honorable Chairman Madam, Ambassador Venter, Chris Mahagra, members of the committee. I want to thank you very much all for inviting me to speak, for giving the opportunity for our diplomatic mission to address a body of parliament once again. We welcome, I personally welcome, the privilege of addressing a committee like this one. For three basic reasons, I would say. First, because I feel passionate about Cuba, about what our country stands for, about the Cuban Revolution, and therefore I treasure any opportunity to be able to speak about Cuba. Secondly, because of something that has been mentioned here, the strength of the bilateral relationship between Cuba and South Africa, and the belief that the more that we learn about each other, the better we can work and serve our respective peoples. It's a relationship based on historical ties between our peoples, based on Cuba's long commitment and solidarity with the peoples of Africa in general, and also based on our admiration for the hard struggle of liberation in South Africa, and to the role that South Africa already plays and can play internationally as an important international actor. The third reason why I welcome this opportunity is for what I normally call the media challenge, or we could call it that way, referring to the amount of resources, time, and space that is frequently dedicated to propaganda against Cuba, which results in that when one looks at the big media, above all the corporate media or the media that is run by large corporations, the picture and the image that is painted of Cuba is very distorted, and I believe that if I have the opportunity to speak in South Africa to try to counter that bias, I should take advantage of it. I will speak about some of the current affairs in Cuba, issues that are currently happening in our country, but that are, in our opinion, crucial for South Africans to understand in order to build on what both the chairman and Ambassador Bender were talking about. I will first mention some important facts, and I hope you bear with me this. Cuba's GDP at current prices is roughly $71 billion. That implies that we don't have a large economy. If one looks at the rank, by whatever source, Cuba is in the rank of around 66 of the 190 countries or so that exist in the world. In other words, we don't have a large economy. To give you an idea, South Africa ranks 27, 28, 29. Our GDP per capita is $6,300. In other words, that's the GDP divided into our population. In that figure, we would rank 92. Again, to give you a comparison idea, South Africa would rank 77. I put these facts to help you understand that we believe, and we are, in terms of fact, a poor country in terms of economic performance. We have a modest economy, and our per capita, in terms of our population, is also modest. So we are a poor nation, and we have a poor population when one looks at the world as a whole. Now, if you look at the social indicators, the picture is a bit different. Our life expectancy at birth is 78 years. That places Cuba, in terms of ranking, at 38. To give you an idea, South Africa is 165. Our infant mortality rate is 4.9 per 1,000 live births. That places Cuba at 55, just after the Netherlands, and in a better position than the United Kingdom and the United States. Our public health system is free, it's public, it's universal. Our literacy rate is 98%. We have the 2% that one takes people, disabled people, people that don't have, for whatever reason, are not having the opportunity of schooling. Education is also free, public, and universal. And our rank in what the United Nations considers the Human Development Index is 59. We are in the top level of what are considered the countries with high rank in terms of Human Development Index. 40 million. Now, with these figures, you could appreciate the contrast between our limited economic strength and our social achievements. They are the result of a political will of wanting to expand social justice to the maximum extent possible, while we've had a limited performance in terms of our economic development. Our best assets as a nation are our human development, expressed in strong human resources, and generalized equity. I think it would be difficult in today's world to find a country more equitable or with a more generalized equity than in Cuba. We continue to rank above many countries with higher gross national income in terms of our per capita distribution. We are above the average Latin American countries in the Caribbean, and above average countries considered within the high human development group. There's a quote by the UN written in the Human Development Report that says, "For both societies and individuals, what is decisive is not the process of wealth maximization, but how they choose to convert income into human development." We believe that is a reality of income. So we could feel satisfied with the fact that we have achieved social justice and that wealth, whatever wealth we have, is distributed in an equitable manner. But it would be irresponsible and it would be a great mistake to feel satisfied with that and to think that that is enough. Our economy needs to build its economic development. It's not enough to say that we are fair. We need to improve the well-being of our population. And to do that, we need to overcome concrete limitations we have. If we were to try to synthesize which are the basic limitations for Cuban economic development today, we would say it's three of them. One, the lack of significant natural resources. Cuba is a country that does not have significant natural resources. We don't have oil, petroleum in sufficient quantities. We do not have natural gas. We do not have important water resources to use hydropower. We don't have coal. Therefore, just in terms of energy, the natural resources of Cuba are very weak. We are dependent on foreign actors. We don't have important minerals. We don't have gold, or at least strategic gold, platinum, uranium, other strategic minerals that also have a high value in the market. We do have nickel and we have cobalt, and they are important, but their prices fluctuate and they don't have the weight of other important strategic minerals. We have land, but our fertile land has limited fertility. To produce tropical goods, we cannot produce wheat in Cuba, for example. We have limitations on the cattle that we can produce because of the conditions of a tropical country. So the limitation of natural resources is one major obstacle for Cuban development. A second major obstacle was already mentioned here today, is the U.S. economic blockade, which is greatly misunderstood and normally insufficiently understood. First, I have to say that, and I will take some time in this, it has lasted more than 50 years, over a century of an economic warfare against a small nation by the largest economic power that exists and has existed. It is a formal policy with a legislative mandate from the U.S. government. It implies that everybody knows the prohibition to trade bilaterally. In other words, we are barred from the largest market in the world, which is just across the Florida Strait, 90 miles away from Cuba. But this prohibition to trade is not simply that we cannot buy goods in the U.S. nor sell our goods from Cuba in the U.S. It implies that we cannot buy in South Africa any good that has more than 10% of U.S. material or component or U.S. technology, regardless of the relationship that we have with South Africa or the relationship that South Africa might have with the United States. It implies that, to give an example, we cannot trade with South Africa, we cannot purchase in South Africa any good that has more than 10% of U.S. material, origin, or technology. Even if it's really a South African product produced by South African workers in South African industry by a South African company, and regardless of the relationship of South Africa with Cuba or South Africa with the U.S. And this applies to China, Russia, Spain, any country in the world. It implies that we cannot sell our nickel, our sugar, to give an example of two raw materials from Cuba, to any company that has the U.S. market as a target. Now, how many companies in today's world refuse to use or to at least aspire to sell their product, to materialize their activity in the U.S. market? So you can understand the tremendous limitations put to Cuban trade. No ship that touches a Cuban port, commercial ship, can touch a U.S. port in 6 months. Now imagine if we were to a ship were to travel with wheat or whatever, or maize from South Africa to Cuba. That South African ship cannot touch a port at the other side of the Atlantic of the largest market in the world for 6 months. Anybody who understands anything about shipment will can appreciate the limitations it has for trade, because it implies great cost in trying to find shipping lines that are ready to carry products from Cuba or to take products from Cuba to other markets. We have no access to the capital pool of the United States, in other words, the financial assets of the United States for credit, for investment. But we also have no access to international financial institutions, because by law, they are prohibited by the United States to engage with Cuba. This implies that Cuba is perhaps the only developing country that has no access whatsoever to preferential trade for long and medium-term investment. None whatsoever, anywhere, from anywhere in the world. And you can understand the impact that this has for our developmental needs. We do not have access to technology, to U.S. technology. To give you an idea, at some point, we were doing a joint venture with a Canadian-British company to develop grass for golf courses in Cuba, so that it could be indigenous to Cuba adaptation. The project had to be stopped, because the grass seeds were a result of genetic result of technology from the United States, and therefore that joint venture with a Canadian-British company could not materialize in grass for golf course. Just to give you an example, this is repeated everywhere. And finally, we have in today's world the persecution of Cuban financial transactions all over the world. The capacity of U.S. because of technology, and because after September 11, 2001, the new agreement of the U.S. and the new measures taken by the international banking community, the Cuba's financial transactions have become more transparent for the United States and easier for them to damage them, to freeze assets, and to limit our trade and our economic activity with most countries in the world. And that, by the way, includes South Africa. We have that. It's something that has damaged the relationship between our two countries. The aim of this policy is to defeat the Cuban Revolution by hardship, destitution, and hunger. And I understand that the Charter of the Fair, when he came last time, he quoted here in this committee a passage of something said by the then Secretary of State in the 1960s. Now, this economic blockade is the second big obstacle we have for economic development. The third one is our great economic inefficiency. And we have to recognize that, and we are recognizing our economy, our policies, our governmental policy in terms of economy is very inefficient. Now, we cannot change our natural conditions. If we have limited or poor natural resources, there's nothing we can do about it. We can continue to explore and try to find oil, but it's not something that is within our reach. We cannot change U.S. policy towards Cuba. We hope it would change. The international community hopes it would change, and every year it pronounces itself at the U.N. General Assembly. But truly, we have no indication that there will be a change anytime soon in U.S. policy towards Cuba in terms of the economic blockade. So what leaves us that is the economic inefficiency. That is our fault. That is something on which we can work. And that brings me now to try to explain what we call the updating of the Cuban economic model. More or less, that's what you try to capture in the title of today's meeting. We call it updating of the Cuban economic model. This updating of the Cuban economic model, which is today a basic policy of the country, the economic policy and a basic government policy in the country, is the result of a comprehensive and thorough process of consultation with the population. A general draft was prepared, and hundreds of thousands of meetings took place in Cuba. Any Cuba who wanted to question, contribute, support, amend, or propose an amendment to this document had the possibility to do it at least in 2 to 3 meetings. I myself participated in 3 because I participated in my union, I participated in my neighborhood organization, and also in my Communist Party side. So I had 3 opportunities to speak. You could, if you belong to the artist organization, you could participate, and religious organization, you could participate, Women's Federation for Women. So you have opportunities to 3, 4, or 5 chances to be able to make your input, put your input into this process. The result of this very comprehensive and thorough process of consultation was taken to the Congress, the Communist Party. There they approved the guidelines, the economic guidelines for updating our model in the country. And then this was taken to the National Assembly, where after consideration and amendment, it was put into law. It is today a legal mandate of Cuba's National Assembly, Cuba's Parliament. Now, which are the basic elements of this updating of the economic model? First is the aim to diversify our economy. We cannot continue to depend on sugar exports as we did in the past, or on nickel exports, or in tourism. We have to go beyond them. Develop new sectors of the economy. Take advantage of our human resources, of the educational, scientific, and technological capability we have built to export services, and to try to have more sectors of the economy on which to depend. We need to diversify international borders. The history of Cuba, at least in the 20th century, was a total dependency. More than 90% of our foreign engagement was with the United States. As a result of the U.S. economic blockade, we reached out to the Soviet Union, which lent us a hand in those times, but we concentrated more than 80% of our external economic relations with basically the Soviet Union, but also former socialist powers. In the 90s, all that broke. Took Cuba to a profound crisis. Today, we have a more diversified external sector. We have important trade and economic relationship with Venezuela, of course, with China, trade with Spain, with Canada, and we have found new import actors for us, among them Brazil. In the case of Africa, Algeria and Angola have become important partners for us. In Asia, Vietnam has continued to be. Japan and even South Korea have become trade partners with Cuba. Yet we want to expand that. And when we do that, we have in mind, of course, South Africa also as one of our priorities. We have to make structural adjustment in our country to release our collective forces. We recognize that policies and legislation and regulations that we have in place in Cuba limit the development of our productive forces, and we have to change that and make the necessary structural adjustment to do. We're not planning, and I say this, to change the essence of our socialist economic model and the dependence fundamentally on public or state ownership of the main productive forces, but we do have to expand and go beyond dogmatic approach to that. Part of the important elements of these economic guidelines is to protect the social achievements of our country, some of which I mentioned, but the others. We cannot and will be accepted for the Cuban population for us to undertake a process seeking economic efficiency at the cost of damaging our social justice or the achievements we've had in the social sector. We do not see a contradiction, and we would not accept a contradiction between economic efficiency and social justice, or between mechanization of our economic performance with the solidarity nature of our society. To put it in the words of our president, Raúl Castro, we need to build and develop a prosperous and sustainable socialist society. And he put an emphasis in both those words, prosperous and sustainable. Prosperous because that's why it's not enough to have a fair distribution of our wealth if this wealth is very modest. We need to develop our economy, enrich our nation so that we improve the well-being of the population. And sustainable because it has to be sustained in the long run. It cannot be dependent on the relationship with one, two, or three countries, and it cannot be dependent on the eventual goodwill of the United States to the economic blockade. It has to be sustainable within the conditions and in spite of the conditions of U.S. policy towards Cuba, which is something that's beyond our reach or our capacity to change. Now, what actions have we undertaken or are we undertaking in this regard to implement these guidance? Among others, we strengthened our strategic planning at the macroeconomic level with a view of having a macroeconomic balance of the economy. But at the same time, we are allowing and promoting self-regulation at the entrepreneurial and business level and allowing market mechanisms to influence, to participate, and to regulate the relationship at the entrepreneurial and business level. We think, contrary to what we've thought in the past, that there's no contradiction with the socialist nature of our society and the use of market mechanisms at the entrepreneurial and business level. That's an important change in our economic policy. We have to detach, and we are detaching the government from direct management of economic and business activities. Because of the state nature of our economy and its overwhelming weight in terms of poverty, we fell into the trap of having government agencies, ministries, departments, doing the direct management of all, at some point, practically 100% of the economic activity. We are detaching the government from that. Government institutions and organizations do not have a role in the management of entrepreneurial and business activity. They do at the planning of the macroeconomic level, but not at managing the economy and, again, business and entrepreneurial activities. We're eliminating outdated and, in some cases, unjustified prohibitions that were born as defense mechanisms, as mistaken theoretical thoughts, or were born as a result of specific conditions or one moment in our lives, but that do not have value or are not valid at this moment. And we are in the process of eliminating many of them. We have to change, we have to update or eliminate regulations that limit or that put obstacles to entrepreneurial activity. In the past, we used to be afraid of that. We have to, again, change, update, or eliminate, in some cases, regulations that have existed or some exist still in our country and that are obstacle for entrepreneurial activity. We have to promote non-state actors in managing and developing the economy. This does not mean that we have within our plans the idea of privatizing the Cuban economy, of taking the economic assets that today belong to the people of Cuba, state-owned, and privatize them. The idea will be to promote new actors, in other words, new business that can pop up that are not state-owned, but more important than that, to have non-state actors managing state assets. In other words, you can take an enterprise, you can take a specific business that belongs to the state, that's publicly owned, but that can be managed by a private company in Cuba. We have already been doing that for the past 20 years in the tourism sector. Ambassador Fender put the example of the big Sol Meliá company, tourism company, that today, I would say, manages over 55 or perhaps 60% of Cuba's main hotels in terms of tourism. Cuba is the owner of the hotel, but it's managed by this Spanish company. And our aim is to promote that kind of activity in all sectors of the economy, but basically with Cuban participants, but we also welcome foreign participants, but Cuban participants, that in a private manner they can manage a state-owned or a public asset. We are promoting foreign investment more than we did in the past. We're not changing the legislation at the moment. We think we can do that further on as we gain experience. But in terms of policy, we're promoting it more. Ambassador Pender mentioned some of the sectors: tourism, mining, manufacturing, oil exploration, chemical industry. And if we could have South African interest in that, it would be welcome to you. We have the very, very difficult task of having a currency and price reform in Cuba. Cuba today, for those of you who have been acquainted or have visited Cuba, we have what we call the double currency. You have the Cuban peso, and then we have a convertible peso, which is convertible to dollars in more or less in a one-to-one basis. And this implies a huge distortion of the economy and a negative effect on the well-being of the population. And if you add to that that we use different prices, above all trying to look for justice. And you take, for example, a pound of sugar in Cuba has three prices. You have the subsidized price, then you have a semi-subsidized price, and then you have a price for the convertible peso. At the end, it's the same pound of sugar. So even if the government uses this differential price to try to benefit the ones who need the most, that sugar ends up in the market, in the black market or the informal market, and the effort of different pricing is lost. So we need to find a reform, again, of the currency, to go back to one currency, the Cuban peso, with a new exchange rate closer to what the economic reality dictates, and a pricing policy in the country that allows prices to fluctuate with limits, but with a policy that promotes fair prices for the population. And instead of subsidizing products like sugar, subsidize people, which are the ones that need the sugar. That's an approach we're taking. It's much easier said than done, and I think you could try to pay to find a Cuban that can explain to me how that's going to be done, and you won't be able to fund it, regardless of how much you pay. We have to strengthen our research and development participation in economic development. We have, as we said, strong R&D in our country. We've had it for many years, and in spite of what we ourselves have thought, its link, its participation in economic development has not been as strong as it could have. We have a potential there that we can exploit much more than we've done today. We have to develop new infrastructure. Ambassador Pender again mentioned the case of the port of Mariel in the northwestern part of Cuba. We're doing so in tourism, we're doing so in electricity capacity generation. We have to diversify our energy resources. Cuba today is 96 or 97% dependent on hydrocarbons. That means oil or gas for the production of electricity. We have to change that. We have to reduce that to 80%, if possible 70%. And the only way to do it is going towards new and renewable sources of energy. If we don't do that, our economic balance will always be very difficult for us to manage because of the high dependency on the import of fuel. And compared to this, in terms of magnitude of the problem, is we need to develop our agriculture much more and have substitution, import substitution. We have a high dependency on the import of food, and we need to change that. We need to improve, modernize, and make our agriculture much more efficient, because the food element has another great impact in our balance of payments. Now, all actions, all of this that I mentioned, are being undertaken with extreme considerations to social well-being of the population and to social justice. In other words, we're going to have the government and the state organizations, both economic and non-economic, have to let go of it. We have to streamline our workforce, the one that depends on the state. And we are aware how to do that, but we cannot force this on the population. We cannot have a shock therapy in a country and have the levels of unemployment that could be unstable for our country. So in spite of the initial projections of 3 years ago of having 500,000 and reaching 1 million in some of them, it's going to take us more time because we have to be very careful in the way we do this. And we know that this process will take time. It will require constant consultation with the population. But at the same time, we're clear that we cannot move from this approach, and that the the line that we have taken is one that we cannot move from, and we need to take constant steps in that direction. Now, in terms of our international economic outlook, I have to mention we have greater relations today with Latin America and the Caribbean than we ever had. We have partners like Brazil that have said publicly that they want to become Cuba's main economic partner. They are not today, but they say they want to do it, and we welcome the challenge. We hope they work in that direction. Cuba's economy has a strong dependency on its economic activity because of the limitation of our resources. And we need to seek new markets to procure needed goods. We have a strategy of solving outstanding debt, but at the same time of not engaging in debt when it's unnecessary. Therefore, our economic organizations are ready to pay cash directly if we are able to reach the direct producer. We found examples of traders that we have traditionally used in Europe, Western Europe, and North America because of the credit conditions they give us, and we end up buying in Germany or in Canada South African machinery or Korean machinery. Our aim is to go seek, identify the producer, the direct producer, and if we have to pay cash, it's better than enter into a credit commitment with a European company that then increases the cost of our foreign trade. And that's something that we've explained in the Department of Foreign Affairs here in South Africa of international relations. It's one of the issues that is the new reality in trying to diversify our market, an area in which I believe I coincide that South Africa can play an important role. We have to develop the export of our services, as I said a while ago, based on the strength of our human resources and our experience of cooperating and working in over 150 countries for the past 20, 30 years. Now, which is the role of the relationship with South Africa in this context? We believe that Cuba and South Africa can complement each other based on our respective strengths and our respective weaknesses. The current bilateral trade is truly very modest, very limited between South Africa and Cuba, and it's even today mainly through European third market, basically European. We believe that we need to reverse that situation, and I think that having a participation of Fair in Havana and Cuban companies participating in SciTech here in South Africa can help in that direction, trying to find more links and engage between Cuban partners and South African partners in that regard. And we hope to increase direct purchases in this country for agricultural goods and technology. South African products that are of interest for Cuba, for example, are seeds, fertilizers, tires, plastic resin, equipment, machinery in general for any part of our economy. Cuban products that can be of interest for South Africa are pharmaceuticals, products from biotechnology, medical equipment. Typical textiles like the YOS doesn't have a big impact in the economy, but it's something that we know is popular in South Africa. We have to promote technical assistance in both directions, and I think we have the capability based on our complementarity to do that. We have already experience of cooperating in the medical sector in South Africa, in our opinion, with undeniable results, and we look forward to the mutual plans that we already have in place to expand that. Cuba is actively engaged in research and projects for energy conservation, as well as alternative and renewable forms of energy. South Africa has a strong experience in those fields, and we hope that we can build on our relationship in other forms through business, through cooperation, through technical assistance to try to put our two countries together. Cuba has experience in urban agriculture, livestock integration, bioharvesting production, which we can assure can be of use in South Africa. Cuba can cooperate with South Africa in areas of water quality and irrigation techniques. At the same time, South Africa has a long experience in the mining sector with human capital, know-how, equipment, management knowledge. The mining sector is one target in Cuba for foreign investments, an area in which we hope we can build or we can identify areas to work together. We can expand the existing cooperation in higher education, in ICT technology, in information and communication technology, in which Cuba has built the potential and South Africa has also built the potential. perhaps we can complement what each other do, and how do we take this to society? How do we convert them and use them in social policy? At the same time, the complementary nature of our relationship provides a unique opportunity for Cuba and South Africa to work in other parts of Africa. Both our countries have a demonstrated commitment to the peoples of this continent, and our combined strength can really make a difference. Now, I agreed already to work in that direction, so I think it's time that we start to take concrete steps for us, for our mutual benefit, but for all, above all, for the benefit of the peoples of Africa. I would be failing in my duties and I think committing a moral injustice if I don't speak about the case of the Cuban Five that was mentioned already by the chairman. The case of five Cuban citizens that for the past 15 years have been imprisoned in the U.S. under false charges and as a result of corrupt legal procedures. The case, these are five men that in the 1990s, just to be brief, infiltrated terrorist organizations in Miami, in southern United States, but basically in Miami, to learn about their terrorist actions against Cuba. These are organizations that have already committed actions that already cost the lives of people, plus economic damage. These five men did not infiltrate U.S. government, nor did they act against the U.S. government. They did not harm U.S. citizens, U.S. property, or any institution in the United States. They were arrested in 1998 and condemned in 2001 in what is considered the longest trial in the history of the United States. That's 250 years of history. Longest trial for these men. One of them was sentenced with two consecutive life sentences, and the others with long periods of incarceration. The only motivation behind this is political vengeance against Cuba. An appeals court of the United States, the appeals court of Atlanta, ruled in 2005 that this was an unfair trial and that they should be released. The government, nevertheless, had the capacity to make their case again, and they're still in jail, with the exception of one that served his whole sentence of 15 years. It's an issue that has had a strong media complicity. You do not hear about this in the United States, in spite of its strong political implications and its strong legal implications. There's this absence, there's a vacuum on the subject in the United States. And today, after most of the legal avenue has been approached with failure, it will take an action of the U.S. government to change the situation. There's no other way today to make justice to these five men. They have been accused of terrorism. Many years ago, once Nelson Mandela was accused of terrorism. And we believe that if in February 1990, the then president of South Africa was compelled to act and to liberate Nelson Mandela, we hope someday to find a moment in which a U.S. president, if not this one, but we hope this one, will be compelled to free the Cuban five or four that are remaining in jail. He will not do that as a result of he wakes up and has a change of mind. He will only do it if he's compelled to it by friends of Cuba, by Cubans, and above all, by the people in the United States. I want to say, before I finish, that Cuba and South Africa, as has been said today, enjoy a strong political relationship. We share the goodwill of our respective peoples, and we have a long history of cooperation. Every step that we take to take advantage of those bonds will translate in benefits for our respective peoples, the peoples of Africa, and I think international cooperation as a whole. We truly believe, and I want to say this strongly, that Cuba and South Africa can make an example of two countries that are distant geographically and that can have a very strong relationship and a close bond between their respective people. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No, thank you so much, Ambassador. So we have the last presentation, the second agenda.
Honorable Chair, members, Master Carlos, Number Pentas, Combat Defense. It is the honor for the French Cure Society to have been invited and to come and make a small contribution here. In fact, a couple of years ago, we participated in kind of a similar process of when Alec Gaspar was the speaker, when we were doing a reflection on Kito Kanavari and a role that Cuba played and the implications of those respective addressing some of the legacies that are still with us as a nation trying to overcome the legacy of the past. So we are particularly happy to be part of this process. And just briefly, I think most of the very important aspects about Cuba South African relations have been presented, and there's solid ground to move on those. Just to make the following point, Friends of Cuba Society is a South African civil society organization that brings together the what is possible progressive peoples who support the Cuban Revolution and who support important principles of international law, such as sovereignty, freedom, democracy, and independence. And for the Friends of Cuba Society, we also do that. In the case of Cuba, we think it's important that the Cuban people and the Cuban Revolution also enjoy those types of rights. We're also meeting, we want to note, a day after the 87th anniversary birthday of the leader of the Cuban Revolution, Comandante Fidel Castro. He was celebrating his 87th birthday yesterday, and it's an important milestone. I think if we have time, we could go and talk about Fidel's contribution, both as a revolutionary, but also as an important representation of all that is progressive and possible in the West for humanity, and etc., etc. The French Cuba Society was brought into being in the late mid-1990s, around 1995. Among other things, we were honored that gathering to have the presence of the former president, Nelson Mandela, who reminded us of a very important pillar of our own revolution and of our own struggle, that international solidarity contributed significantly in bringing South Africa closer to the 1994 breakthrough. And if that international solidarity had not played that role, who knows where we could have been, but that element and that pillar of international solidarity was very important. And therefore, in the case of Cuba, we also need a reciprocal responsibility on our part to highlight and engage the Cuban reality with a much more open understanding and appreciation of the Cuban reality. And as Ambassador pointed out earlier on, media coverage of Cuba, including in South Africa, which depends in the mix, in large private commercial media sources such as AFP, Reuters, and us, there's a huge distortion about the Cuban reality. That Cuban reality, we have found out as the Friends of Cuba Society to have been a very different thing. And we speak to some of the work that made us realize that reality. Focus that over the years, Commonwealth Friends worked also with the South African government on a number of states. For example, we've been working with provincial health departments to both identify and prepare some of the potential students that are going to study in Cuba. And we know what the challenges could be. Young 19-year, 20-year-olds going into foreign countries, some of them brought from very rural backgrounds, traveling for the first time abroad. There are huge cultural, psychological, and other challenges. So the Friends of Cuba Society has played a very important role in preparing and conscientizing these potential students that are going to study in Cuba. And other I think we've been doing a very good job over the last so many years, because only recently have we seen a few not so very good reports about our students in Cuba. But President Cuba decided also to engage in the matter and actually expand its work to include the National Health Department. One of the other, I think, very critical work that the Friends of Cuba Society has been doing, which will be of interest to you, is we undertake annually what we call work brigades to Cuba. And these work brigades to Cuba have a number of important achievements in them. Just to mention two. One, that we are exposing ordinary South Africans to the Cuban reality by taking them to Cuba. And they are going to Cuba not as tourists. It would be nice if they go as tourists. They pay with the convertible peso or whatever. But we're taking them to Cuba as ordinary South Africans hosted by a Cuban counterpart organization. They are not tourists. They have the possibility of engaging ordinary Cubans in their daily lives, in their daily reality, outside of the facade. And that's an important, I think, intervention that the Friends of Cuba Society is making in terms of making South Africans understand and appreciate the Cuban reality beyond what the media has been giving us. And we think for a whole range of reasons, not least the fact that we also even have a large number of South African students there. There is another added function that the Friends of Cuba Society has moved. But we're becoming a courier between the students in Cuba and their parents back home. And at times what the students really need, you know, they just need a two-paragraph, three-paragraph letter that says, Mommy, I'm still okay, and that type of thing, etc., etc. And we can play that connector between the students in Cuba and the parents back home. The parents back home will know when the Friends of Cuba Society undertakes the annual brigade, and we publicize this, and they would, from time to time, give us even small things, you know, mementos, photos of this and that, and et cetera, et cetera. And we'll see how this contributes in the correct fomentation and the social fortification of the students in Cuba. And we think it's an important dimension that the Friends of Cuba Society has been undertaking. I mean, as a non-state organization, as a civil society organization, some of our responsibilities also include accessing the work of the state outside of the organs of state. Because we think, as Ambassador correctly pointed out, that the Cuban reality is not necessarily protected correctly in our media. And that's why important calendar dates that have to do with the Cuban Revolution, etc., the Friends of Cuba Society, we make it a point to organize activities around those, whether it is the July 26th activities, we organize people to come, and we speak about the implications of July 26th and what it has, and all of the other important aspects, the 1st of January, the strength of the Cuban Revolution itself, including the marking the birthday of Jorge Martí. And this reminds some of us of the very important contribution, unsung heroes and heroines of the resistance wars in our country have also played. Some of them, we don't even know who they are, we don't even know where they are buried. But Cuba is very strong on its historic background and teaching in that resistance fighters such as Jose Marti and others, Antonio Maceo, are remembered, and that tradition is carried on from generation to generation. We think as a Friends of Cuba Society, that's an important dimension and aspect that we also have to take into account. Some of the key programs that the Friends of Cuba Society engage in, as has been mentioned, one of them is the Free the Fire campaign. Because we think the Free the Fire campaign has many similarities and similarities between our own situation in the pre-1994 setup. But also, of course, it is a violation of every other prescript of international law that people have been held in jails in the U.S. and their families and other people do not have access to them, their wives, children, and etc. are unable to visit them. And in fact, the U.S. administration is in violation of international human rights when it does not allow even convicted prisoners to be visited by their closest friends or their closest family members. Some of the wives of the five have not seen their husbands for almost 15 to so many years. And that is an unacceptable situation. And we think we must continue to raise this matter and we must continue to fight it. In fact, Amnesty International itself has recently made the point that the case of the FARC represents the gross manipulation of the justice process in the United States. Fortunately, in our case, we've had Father Michael Lansley, who you know, is also involved in the process of reconciliation through his Healing Memory Institute, and etc. And he has, on a regular basis, visited one of the five Hernando in the California prison, and he has been sentenced for 2 lives. So that interaction and engagement was quite for the Michael Lansley. We think it's also very important a contribution on our part for the fact for the particular Hernando to deal with the situation that he finds himself in today. The second very key important program that we are involved in is what we call the normalization of relations between the United States and Cuba. We think it's very important. In fact, historically there have been relations between the two countries up until the point where the 1959 period, the antagonism between the U.S. and Cuba commenced, the Bay of Pigs, etc., etc. But the point is that ordinary American people have found resonance and continue to engage ordinary institutions and ordinary Cubans. But they are prohibited by law to do that because the U.S. has regulation of contact and or engagement with Cuba. And that we find to be also a gross violation of human rights. These are all the things that we think we must continue to flag. And therefore the notion of the normalization of relations between the U.S. and Cuba is an important aspect. So even when we interact, we've had couple interactions with the Black Caucus in the U.S. and they have supported our stance and they have come on board. And actually we've been working with them in the International Association for the Five Committee. And they have assisted us a great deal, including lawyers that represented the five. The third key important program that we are engaged in was the ending of the economic blockade and the implications of the blockade Gambaga was pointing out and what the blockade has done over the so many decades of its enforcement. An important aspect about the economic blockade is also that it has a feature of extraterritorial power that Gambaga was speaking about. And we think is an important aspect that democratic South African progressives needs to engage and grapple with and to find a mechanism to deal with it. Besides the many important aspects, you know, that we've been mentioning, the history and et cetera, et cetera. But some people might ask, why do we support Cuba? We think we support Cuba for the following reason, and they're not necessarily the only reason. Cuba has one of the highest literacy rates in the world. Of course, that's a good reason why we should be supporting Cuba. Cuban health is free, universal, and high quality. In fact, Kofi Annan is quoted as having said, and I quote, Cuba demonstrates how much the nation can do with the resources they have if they focus on the right priorities, health, education, literacy. Close quote. Education in Cuba is free, universal, and high quality. In fact, the ambassador was talking about the rankings in here. We can also add this particular ranking from UNESCO's Education for All Development Index. It ranks Cuba number 16. What's it? What would be also particularly very important for us is that Cuba is dealing with the legacy of racism, and that has been wiped out. It's very important for us as South Africa. And that the month of August, Women's Month, we cannot but mention that women's rights in Cuba have been actively promoted and supported. And there is the community spirit in Cuba, the huge cross consultations about policy issues and a whole range of other things that the others were talking about, are just an illustration of the community spirit that exists in Cuba. And for us, it's going to be important to draw lessons from that. If, for example, we're going to, as we're piloting co-ops, that spirit of community development and community cohesion is very key. And therefore we think it's one of the issues that need to flag as an important reason why we're supporting Cuban revolution. And finally, we just think the ambassador underplayed this part. Cuba's efforts to try and deal with its energy deficiency has actually played out important lessons in Cuba. Mm-hmm. In fact, many people don't even realize that during the special period when Cuba's energy sources were dwindling, Cuba creatively worked out a whole range of other strategies to address the matter. Part of it has even community involvement in it. It might sound simplistic, but for example, the energy guzzling utensils that the Cubans had during the predominant period of the Soviet investment in Cuba, such as washing stoves, washing machines, including gloves and etc., those things were programmed in place to replace all of those and replace them with energy-efficient units. But that had a community involvement in it. So when people were bringing these things back, the community was getting involved, putting in the new necessary things. That's an important element, right? It's an important thing of involving our communities in appreciating both the public assets and other things that advance and develop their lives. And we think it's an important element to highlight. Thank you very much, Chairperson of the session. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
And applause in order for all the presenters. Thank you so much for your presentations, gentlemen. What a pity there's no link, especially for this month. What we will do right now is we'll break for lunch and continue subsequently after that. It's almost 1:30. Can we be back here by 2? Is it reasonable? By 2? That will allow us to finish earlier. Okay, thank you so much. Stand adjourned for the moment. Okay, thank you. Let me first take this opportunity to welcome the Honorable John Phelps, the Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry. Thank you so much, Honorable Fabs, for your attendance. Honorable members, we've had all three presentations from the two ambassadors and the Secretary General. It's my opening up for you to comment and engage and ask questions and do everything you want to do pertaining to the presentation. So I would restrict you, if it's questions for clarity, that's fine. If it's comments, if you go into discussion, it's up to you. Okay.
Thank you very much, Chair. I've just got a few things out here. What is the population of Cuba at the moment? And what is the percentage of jobless people? And with all this, a lot of everything is concentrated around the government, is there a lot of corruption? What's the corruption level there? And you mentioned the Communist Party. Is there other parties involved as well? And are we having elections? And the outcome of the elections, can there be a change from one party to another? Then I would like to know about training. We've got some of the best hospitals and training facilities in the world. And we're all known for Kisbana, who's his heart transplant and all that. Why? And there's a lot of our training facilities that's closing down in South Africa. I would like to know, why do we specifically have our people train there and not here? Of course, the money that we spend here is for our economy much better. Then I can see that the big problem is lying between the United States of America and Cuba. And as soon as they can come around a table or something, then something can happen. Otherwise, not. I would like to know, what have we done from South Africa's side to influence through the different, like the African Unity or with the BRIC countries? Have we had it on the agenda yet and tried to work out something and enforce it to find out what's going on? Then I would like to know, what is the main things that America, what are the main reasons that there's still so much against Cuba? And what can we as South Africans do to help them? Thank you.
Must apologize, I could only be here for this time because I would have liked to have attended the entire dialogue. But Cuba is very much on our minds, certainly in trade and industry as well, in particular because of the bilateral that we're facing, that we passed in the National Assembly. And I'm not sure if that issue did come up earlier this morning as to, you know, I was just surprised that 7 months later it remains, it hasn't yet been able to be implemented, can I put it this way? I'm not saying unprocessed, because quite clearly processes have been implemented, but they have not yet led to the grant and the loan and the funds being transferred to Cuba. And it struck me it was urgent. That was the one issue. The second issue is in the light of strategic, you know, geographical and political considerations, including the economic. And it is linked to one of the statements made just as I came in at that particular point by Comrade Mr. Tiepel, I should say, Mr. Young, Placo. And that is, you know, there are many lessons we could learn from Cuba as a country, where we're having so many needs to finance, support, resource, deliver on, and our budget is so limited. How did they do it? How were they able to do it? What are the measures that they put in place? What policy or attitude or approach did they adopt in order to deliver the critically urgent issues? The final thing linked to that is its position as a small country, flanked by much, much larger nations and countries, with that tremendous, what can I call it, with, while still remaining diplomatic, this is international relations and consideration. Can we say that they pose even a latent or potential threat, so that Cuba in many ways is under that constant sword of Damocles in many ways, and yet it is not provocative. It seeks to develop in a peaceful manner. So I think there are two things here. How did that policy of theirs, if you like, develop? How did it germinate to what it is today? And secondly, the issues around the bilaterals themselves. And thirdly, the issues in relation to delivery linked to a small purse. Thank you.
Okay. All right. In addition, may I just perhaps add that everyone else is, or everybody is allowed to contribute to engage, ask questions, and so on. It's not limited to the honorable members only. On page 7, Ambassador, you of your presentation, you set out what the economic assistance package consists of. What I want to know is, let's use that as a checklist, right? And tell us the millions, the 1 million, the 100 million solidarity grant. Is it done? Have the seats been purchased? You know, and then so on. Can you give us an update of that? It's one thing to say this has been allocated, or this is what has been agreed to, but what has been done thus far, so that we get a sense, and what are the, as Honorable Fab said, what are the impediments if some of these things have not been delivered yet? The second one that relates to the coordination between the various departments. Now, it's obvious, at least to me, that DIRCO, together with all the other departments, have to coordinate their work. And this does not only relate to, you know, to this matter before us, but in all other spheres, in all other fields, and in relation to all other work that we do. And this is not always happening. And I'll give you an example. While our country is increasing its presence, and there is a deliberate and conscious push to expand our trade, economic, and commercial footprint to help us achieve our domestic priorities on one hand, that necessarily requires that we have trade and economic experts located within missions, which are the nodal point for our government activities all over the world. While we're doing that, we are expanding our diplomatic missions. Our trade component is shrinking. Less and less, you know, trade-related or trade and economic-related diplomats can be found in our missions. Now this, in my view, at least, or at least again, obvious to me, militates against, you know, this broader strategy, because I hold the view, and so do my colleagues, and I can certainly say for members of the ANC, the ruling party, that for us, the conduct foreign policy is not a novelty. It's not an end in itself. It must, as a matter of course, help us, you know, deal with our domestic challenges at home. So I'm just giving you the context so that you understand, you know, where the question comes from. So is this coordination taking place? And then I think the last thing, and both members raised it, that ambassador that you provide us with the historical context, historical, you know, context of the underlying reasons for the US's orientation towards Cuba, so that members have a better grasp of what led to what we see today. Surely the question right there. Okay, that's fine for now.
Thank you very much. I would answer, or try to answer, some of them. The first honorable member asked, for my count, around 7 questions, and I think I can try to answer 6 of them. And the last one I will combine with your last question about the historical background. First, the issue of unemployment. The figure I do not have exactly, but I need to explain that it's a moving element for us, because historically, we would consider unemployed anybody who was not employed by the state, because we have state-owned funds. But that was a misrepresentation, because people had some kind of private activity, formal or informal. If they were a barber or a gardener, that would not be registered as employment, and yet the person would be working and earning. So we are in the process today, with the changes that were taking place in Cuba, of restructuring a statistical register of what unemployment is and adapting it to the extent possible to the way the UN and the WTO measure it. But you can say that today unemployment would be below 4% in Cuba. And it would have been greater if after 2010 and 2011, when we started our changes and we said that we wanted in so many months to have 500,000 of the people in government to start doing non-government, in other words, private or self-employed activity and so on. The idea was to do that fast. And then we learned that the non-state sector could not grow at the speed that we wanted. And so we had to stop releasing people from the job until conditions are so that a person leaves a government job, but he has a place to go to, and he doesn't remain unemployed. In terms of corruption, there's always some level of corruption anywhere where there's management of an important amount of resources and resources that are not owned by the person who's management. So that exists everywhere, and to some extent it exists in Cuba. We're trying to tackle it. But what we consider in Cuba corruption, to give you an example, is when you have a government organization where there's subsidized gasoline, and that person takes some of the gasoline of his tank and half of it sells it. That's the level of corruption you have in Cuba. I'm not talking about huge amounts, but you can take and use it in comparison to other parts of the world. So it would be absurd, and it would be a lie to say there's no corruption in Cuba. Absurd, and it would be a lie. But at the same time, we do have, but corruption is not a basic issue, and we are taking strong political measures for it not to become an issue, because there are signs in the context of the changes that we're taking that could blow in our face. So every step we take, we want to be sure that it's happened. We have cases. We have two ministers that have, one was in jail and the other one's already still there because of charges of corruption, was helping some family members to obtain a job or something like that. We are strong in our policy, strong in our legislation, and it's issues that we pay much attention to. Elections, we have elections at the national level every 5 years, national and provincial levels every 5 years, and every 2.5 years at municipal levels. In other words, people elect every 2.5 years the members of the municipal assembly, delegates, we call delegates to the municipal assembly, which in turn is the municipal assembly that elects the municipal government. Every 5 years, the members of the provincial assembly, which in turn elect a provincial government, and every 5 years also the members of the national assembly, which we call deputies of the national assembly, which is the one that elects the members of the council of state and the president of the council of state, which is the president of the government. In Cuba, we have one party, which is the Communist Party. There's no other party. About training, I don't have another I think it's better for the government. Population of Cuba is 11.2 million. And the last question, the main reason of why for you, the current U.S. policy toward Cuba, or the current or past 50 policy to Cuba. One has to take two references for this. One is, what does the U.S. government say? In the 60s, it was that we were supporting revolutionary movement in Latin America, and we were importing an alien ideology into the Western Hemisphere. And that was against the Monroe Doctrine. That was what was said in the 60s. By the 70s, it was that plus our military involvement in Angola. In the 80s, there were three conditions for us, for the U.S., and it was said explicitly several times, including the U.N., for the U.S. to lift the embargo. It was said publicly and directly to us. There were three conditions. Cuba had to break or sever its ties with the Soviet Union. Second, Cuba had to withdraw its troops from Angola. And third, we had to support the revolutionary movement in Central America. Today, the Soviet Union does not exist anymore. Cuba has no troops in Africa, and there's no revolutionary movement in Central America. There's a revolutionary government in Nicaragua, but not a movement that we could, because there's no revolutionary war there. So if one were to follow the motives or the pretext used by the United States, one could get lost here, but the reason why the policy is in place. Our view is that simply the United States did not accept then, and to a great extent does not accept now, for there to be a political economic process in the Western Hemisphere that challenges their view of regional and international domination. And there's a huge amount of literature related to the reality of today's world and the capacity of the U.S. economically, militarily, to establish domination around the world, even if we don't talk about Cuba. There's lots of literature about that, and it's done through many ways, including the use of the Washington Consensus. There's an article today related to South Africa in the city, I think it's at the Star, I think it's a newspaper, an interview with Santi Terablanche, in which he speaks about that. And there's a point where he said the United States will not accept any nation to challenge their scheme, their international scheme. Well, when one reads that, one thinks, well, that one example is Cuba. That interview is up to Santi Terablanche, a professor from Stellenbosch, I guess. He says that he's not speaking about Cuba, he's speaking about South Africa. But I think that's one example of Cuba, if one reads that point. Thank you.
Yeah, I can try and give a stab at training one. In essence, I think we must bear in mind, and this is a little bit outside of our domain, but if you look at the history before 1994 and the assistance that we received from Cuba in training students in various disciplines, etc., after 1994, when we started and we had to start transforming, we had to find more doctors for our hospitals, we needed engineers, etc., Cuba was magnanimous enough to say, we will help. I think that's very important. Secondly, Cuba has got the facilities to train, and they are training not only for South Africa, but I think there are many, many countries who have students there. Our students have, as I mentioned, drastically gone up, about 1,400 now, and it will increase because of this expanded and this new agreement that we signed last year. But having said that, you also have seen in the press that our Minister of Health is saying, but we've got to look at our own facilities, etc. But for the time being, the Cuban assistance in terms of scholarships, but we've also got students paying their own way, I think is making a huge contribution to a need that we have. I also mentioned that we have engineers, etc., that have come to help us. So it's not limited only to the medical side. You asked about negotiations, BRICS, etc. I don't think any of us would really like to venture on that for the simple reason I think you will go if the parties want you to go and approach you to go. You know, you cannot impose yourself on a thing like this. Ms. Fuchs, if I can just go on, if you don't mind, Chair. On the economic assistance program, yes, 7 months has passed. One of the biggest problems that we've had is that to get money from here to Cuba, you need banking infrastructure that does not get affected by the legislation of the third party that we refer to. That has been one of the problems. Secondly, the coordination, because it was a DGI agreement, it was the African Renaissance Fund through DERCO, and you had to get an agent or a project manager. And recently in a meeting between ourselves, DGI, and the IDC, it was decided that the IDC will drive this as what they call the state agent. They will make the necessary arrangements now with the banks, etc. So I'm sure we'll have a movement on that. And I think it's everybody would like to have that done as soon as possible. The 40 million grant for the purchase of seeds, etc., that comes, amongst others, and I believe also from the department, a small portion from the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, etc. And it's a logistical thing. As far as I know, we are busy with the Cuban authorities because there's only a small element that is really from our side. They will identify other sources where they would like to procure seeds that we do not have and that they will not procure from us. And then we'll have to follow this thing also with the logistical problems that we have. IDC, as state agent, will look at that. So I, you know, it's taken a long time. We signed in 2012, but some of the problems have been real problems in trying because, quite frankly, if you are a bank and you are an international bank, a South African bank that does international business, you've got to be very careful on how this is done. But I think the solution is there. Chair, so if I look at the checklist, the 100 million, I think, will now, through the IDC and through that mechanism, will move. I think the seed will move. The disbursement of the 5 million here is domestic. The other will depend on where the source is. The Credit Insurance Corporation money, well, that depends on exporters from South Africa, both tranches, the first and the second, which is 210 million. And I would just like to say something about that at the end. Chair, the representation of DTI and economic experts, for the last, I would say, 10 years, we've seen the number of people deployed from DGI has actually decreased, and the responsibility has basically been taken over by DERCO. What we have done in the last, I would say, 2 years, but we stepped that up towards the second 6 months of last year, is to try and empower our people. We started with the younger people before they go out. There's a specific course that is part of the orientation before they go out. We also now have implemented additional 4-5 month courses where people that have not even been identified to go abroad will go on these intensive courses. We've also arranged, for instance, for the second, call it the number two, the second most senior person in missions. We've had courses, for instance, for the Americas, we brought them all together with ETI in Mexico so that we could put them through their faces. We've added a week to the regional heads of mission meetings. So when we had all the heads of mission for Latin America and North America here last year, we also added a week to that three-day conference to bring them up to speed on some of the skills needed and background needed, etc., on economic diplomacy, as we call that. I'm not saying this is the ultimate, but I think it's making a big difference because your prioritization at the missions, economic diplomacy has become a very large percentage of the work to be done. Secondly, the work that is done is based on our priorities. So we want to try and attract, you know, investments to boost our skill, to address unemployment, etc., etc. And for that, you really need the economic policy skills. So as a department, we've really invested quite heavily in that, and it's an ongoing program. If I can just come back, I'd like to make a general observation, and I'm very thankful to the Cuban ambassador for the paper that he shared with us, because I think what we don't always, or we don't know the detail, but the changes that are taking place impact on our engagement and our businessmen's engagement with Cuba. And somehow we are putting certain things in place. We go to trade fairs. We've got so many visits that go to Cuba, as you would know, from different sectors, etc. But somewhere we're passing each other. We're missing the ball. And I think what is really necessary, here we've got in the assistance package, there is 210 million rand that can help those exporters that still need confidence, you know, to get involved. But somewhere, as I said, we're moving past each other, and we've got to find a mechanism where we can sit and focus and say, as Ambassador said, as we have identified, let's call it the energy sector or the tourism sector, the infrastructure for the hospitality, to get those people together to talk and to say, this is what we intend doing, and but we must have a measure that in 6 months' time or a year's time, we can say to each other, but we said we'll do this, etc. Not necessarily the government, but that you have milestones. Because at the moment, it just seems that there's a lot of people traveling, but we don't have that focus. And maybe part of the issue is, what I mentioned, is that there's no structure, you know, for the government and the private sector commercially to deal with the structure on that side, that we can go and we can say, listen, let's focus the energy and not shoot with a shotgun, but try and focus on one or two or three things, meet success, and then carry on. Thank you.
Thanks so much. I'm happy when I hear you've identified this weakness. Okay, before I say something to it, let me give you first.
I was not going to say anything, Chapter 6, but I'm not sure it was, you know, 20 years of our democracy, and the Cuban relation goes far, far back. And the story I tell you is a very amazing story, that our own department is not able to perform, and no mechanism, all the mechanisms that they're talking about on the 19th year is really surprising me. What has been the delay? I understand when you're talking about broadband private sector engagement, but also the failure of our own government not have been able to do anything solid for the past 2 years of our own democracy. The people have been very helpful for our own democracy. For me, I just wanted to give me a sense and make me feel comfortable that I must not be suspicious that we've been also encountered a revolution in this type of development. What is the problem? I don't understand it. That you've not been able to have the Cuban people just in shading with them and making things easier in the type of how they've been defining the problem itself. Where is the challenge? Just help me.
Thank you very much, Chair. I would like to know, if Cuba would allow any other political party to take part in governance, and then the people that was redeployed, that was public servants, in what sectors did they get training, in what sectors are they redeployed, the one that you mentioned? And then I think it's lying with Cuba now to make use of our big friends, that the high and mighty did work through the United Nations to help, because from outside, I think our hands are cut off. We're not talking to the big people up there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chairperson Makama. Look, I certainly appreciate the international payment facility that they do. They are challenging and problematic. Well, we do appreciate that side of things. And obviously we have to work according to legal processes, financial processes. My concern, though, remains that is that the only impediment, the financial one and the transfer of the funds per se? Let's leave the seeds out of it because you made that one very clear. Our seeds are ready, but there are other seeds involved in other countries. We leave that one alone for the moment. But you related the point to, we want to send X amount over, and the implicit in that is that you wouldn't like any deductions arise from that to service the transfer. You never said that, but that's the implication. What you wanted to see was this amount, and it had to get there as that amount. Now, what happens to the cost of the transfer? Who bears that? Is there a shortfall in the way we do bilaterals? That what we vote in the House is net or gross? What is it? Is it in fact a net amount? No, it isn't. You see, that the net amount is what you're saying is now a problem, but we voted for a gross amount before it went through a net. Now that may well be a problem that we need to look at. You see, I'm not saying it is. I'm trying to look at what the problem is there. And on the other hand, Chair, I really want to get around this because, to me, I wouldn't like to go into another term and do an election and learn, as I've heard in other cases, the bilateral still sitting there. You see, that's what I'm worried about. Are there any other impediments other than this transfer that you are talking about? Because I do believe would have been at IEC, it will now be expedited. But it did seem to take a long time before it got to IEC. But don't worry, I also raised the question in trade and industry now that I know where it is.
Okay, thanks. An oversight of my part. Did you want to comment on any of the questions raised? Not now. Okay. Okay. The earlier you raised a matter that relates to third parties. Who was it? Ambassador? Yeah. Who was it? Well, I think it was you, Ambassador. Yeah, we spoke of having to make use of third markets to access some of. Yes. Oh, okay. I want to understand that is it a reality of the embargo? A result of the embargo, or a result of some of the commodities and products that you may not be able to source locally within Cuba. And then I want to link that to the other question where you speak of the purchase of to the tune of the 5 million elsewhere. Is it for the same reason or both? Because to me, in fact, this has been our approach. Whenever we do funding of ARS projects, we would source that a certain amount here, and then most of the funds would be used for products to be sourced from within that economy, so that we make that contribution as well to that economy. But the reasons why this is happening, is it because of either the embargo or the fact that some of the products may not be available in the Cuban market itself? To give effect to our thinking in terms of funding, they're always involved. The partnership, the bilateral relations. Somewhere in your presentation, you spoke of strategic partnership. And I actually searched for my funds upstairs, and I couldn't recall that these relations were ever elevated to a strategic partnership similar to other strategic partnerships, or is it a matter of conception, or is the nature of the bilateral relations that they are a strategic partnership? I guess, and perhaps I should just make this point, perhaps for the benefit of Honorable Hillock. You know, some years ago, when the former President Castro was asked the very same question, or at least along the same lines, not the same question, but along the same lines, that your assistance to South Africa in terms of, you know, training their medical students must be a lucrative, and I'm paraphrasing, okay? I'm paraphrasing, I'm not quoting anybody in the party, might be a lucrative, or in fact there was that implicit suggestion that might be a lucrative, you know, deal. So how much do they pay you? And President Castro then said not a cent. At the time, of course, that has changed over the years. But the point is, initially, it was an altruistic, contribution to our country, born out of Cuba's own internationalist traditions. This happens to be the same progressive internationalist or internationalism that the ANC has adopted. That is why, for instance, you know, at least some of the work that the ANC, I'm talking about my party for a moment, why the ANC has taken a particular view on this matter and on other matters, its role plays in terms of the Palestine-Israeli issue and so on. It's born out of that tradition. Of course, that relationship has morphed over the years, and of course with increasing, costs, limited resources. I mean, it was only natural that we would have to pay, to educate our students in the country. But at least for me, it was a profound statement. And in fact, this statement was confirmed by President Mandela at a later stage. Then it was still President Mandela at a later stage that we're not paying the Cubans. So the approach, therefore, at least that should inform our approach when looking at the South Africa-Cuba relations. They go way, way much more. I mean, the Cuban, our official diplomatic representation, in fact, Cuba was one of the very, very first countries after we attained our freedom. That way we opened an embassy as a democratic government, if not the first one. Wasn't it the first one? But it was one of the very first, where we, as a democratic government now, of course, the apartheid government had diplomatic representation primarily in the West. But when we opened them after 1994, Cuba was one of the first, if not the first, the very first. So it was a relationship that we treasured then. It's a relationship that we continue to treasure. And it's a relationship that has a lot of potential, can expand. And in fact, it is expanding into other areas. That is not only political, because of course, I mean, as you said, it costs money, amongst others, to train our students there. But then again, Cuba has its own socio-economic challenges, and so does our country. And that's what the ambassador was talking about, the complementarity that is there between our two countries and our two economies and peoples for that matter. So, well, that's just my contribution. Let me give it to you now. I'm getting the sense you are exhausting all the questions of the members here. Shall we start with you?
Yes, I'll ask several questions. Sorry. I will answer several of the questions. In Cuba, there's one party, the Communist Party. I should clarify, it's not an electoral party, so it's not easy to compare its role to. But normally in the West, a party is here. It's not electoral. It doesn't participate in elections. and we don't have plans in the future, at least, to concede other parties. The people redeployed from government jobs, it's in every sector, it can happen in every sector, and it has schemes of training, of helping them find a job. On many instances, is commercial activity, as today is run by the government, and the government doesn't want to run them anymore, in many cases. So what we do is, we take a specific business, a specific enterprise, that organization that is government-owned, and the government says, look, what we'll do is, we'll give it to you in management. The priority is still the government will give it to you in management. Create a managing company, but to get the workers, meet, create it, elect your body, your direct, or create a cooperative. Or in some cases, you just give it to people. Do you want to continue the salary worker or just take the business on your own? In other cases, they're encouraged to open business in specific sectors. Encouraged to the point that the government gives them credit, gives them tax holidays and so on, trying for them to build a business, to be able to go on their own instead of depending on the government. It's a very careful process, trying to, and to relocate people in areas. Not everybody will get exactly what they want. It never happens. But we're trying not to build unemployment and not to leave people just in the street without a job or a source of income. With respect to BRIC, I think it's one of the areas with South Africa now chairing with number one help. Cuba currently chairs the community of Latin American and Caribbean states called CELAC, which is an organization that groups the 33 countries of Latin America. It's the only fully integrated organization of Latin America and the Caribbean. Cuba is chair at this moment. And in fact, we're proposing, and we think we will achieve it. We have proposed our Minister of Foreign Affairs, to the South African Minister of Foreign Affairs, to have a CELAC BRICS meeting in New York on the occasion of the General Assembly. Something that CELAC does normally. We have CELAC China, CELAC Russia, CELAC United States, and CELAC European Union, and we are proposing in this occasion to have one with BRICS. Cuba has a very good relationship with BRICS. We have excellent relations with China, excellent relations with Russia. India, good relationship. We don't say excellent because there's not much trade. So our relationship with BRICS would be natural. In the UN, I don't think BRICS can be much of a cue because we're an active member of the UN. We participate almost everybody. We get elected to most bodies. We are an active member there. What happened in the UN is what isolated in the UN is the U.S. policy towards Cuba. I'm not saying that the U.N. is isolated. It would be a misrepresentation. But its policy towards Cuba is isolated. But it's too powerful a country to feel the heat just because of the fact that they are isolated in the UN. But again, we're welcome to work with BRICS, and we're very happy that South Africa is chairing at this moment. Now, regarding the use of third markets, my point was that, and the reason was, is that traditionally we've used traders. I'm talking 50 years to carry out a foreign trade. Traders that were able to avoid sometimes U.S. pressure because of the economic blocking. But also, I tried to explain this, traders that would offer us credit. For a country that has difficulty finding credit to conduct trade, this was the possibility we used. And we used many Spanish, Dutch, British, Canadian, French. But we've come to the point today in which we are trading with companies all those regions for products that are whose origin is South Africa. If we have a good relationship with South Africa, and we're building and we need to continue to build the mechanism for that great relationship, why not go directly to the producer in South Africa? And a difference today from the past is that we want to be less dependent on having to use credit. That's why I say we're ready to make cash. Let's say we find a producer in South Africa, but that because of the size of the production, because of its experience, because of the way itself, does not have the mechanisms or the experience to export to Cuba through credit, they're ready to pay directly in cash. And if we're going to buy machinery, seeds, technology, whatever, South Africa, just do it directly. It's an approach we're taking, I think it will help our bilateral relationship. Now the use, and perhaps you can expand more, the use of other seeds, non-South African, is because the package, as I understood it, contemplates for us to trade things that we can find in South Africa. We can find them in South Africa, we prepare, but there are other seeds that we need to import for our agriculture that are not found in South Africa. Or the seed exists in South Africa, but does not comply with Cuba's climate conditions, and therefore cannot be used And the package allows you to look for that in a third party.
Sure, that takes care of the seed. Ms. Tubbs, I just want to mention that I really cannot tell you exactly, because that's something that IDC and DTI will deal with, the bank costs, etc. But the holdup was to find a bank that could effect the transfers. So that was the technicality, more so than anything else, within this international legal framework, bearing in mind that there are certain limitations, etc. Chair, the strategic partnership, in my paper it does not mention a strategic partnership, but I think we have always viewed, by the nature of our relationship and the deep historical relationship, that it is tantamount to a strategic partnership. The absolute very closeness that we have, I've actually not come across anything that, you know, has put that at a secondary level. And I don't know if the ambassador has anything.
You said key partnership.
No, it's absolutely a key partnership. But I think, you know, you'll find that in many fora, etc., we've always referred to Cuba as a strategic friend and partner. Mm-hmm. Then I would just like to go to the first question of the last 20 years, because I think that's an interesting question. And if I look at the institutional infrastructure we have in the last 10, 13 years since 2000, with a ministerial binational commission, which has not met as regular as probably foreseen originally, but was probably because it was overtaken by the deputy ministerial joint consultative mechanism. Now that mechanism meets, or tries to meet, at least once a year to try and guide the different disciplines and different sectors that we have. And I dare say, separate from that, you also have the Minister of Trade and Industry that regularly interacts with his counterparts in Cuba. So we're trying at a different front. We as DIRCO also, for instance, have a very regular formal meeting with the Minister. And I dare say, I think in our part of the world that I deal with, we don't do with any other country, where we sit once a month with the ambassador and his staff, and we go through everything and see what we can do, what we can't do, etc. But having said that, I just want to come back to my original remark. I would very much like to try and find something where we could say, let's focus on one or two things. And hopefully, as I mentioned, we've also tasked our embassy to engage with the Chamber of Commerce, etc., so that we can start identifying certain sectors. And we will share that with trade and industry, because they mobilize the people that will be going to the Havana Trade Fair, so that we can start bringing all these things together and that don't move past each other. Because I really think, and I think the ambassador will agree with me, if we can succeed with that, even if it starts small, bearing in mind, as we said, there are a lot of impediments to just, you know, have a big bang type of thing. But as we go along, and I also think that it's a question of, and this is why I'm pleased about the export cover, because you've got to also get people to get confidence, because what happens is, you know, they go there, they hear about the problems, and this is what the Cubans share with us, and then they don't see the people again.
Yeah.
So this is something we've got to overcome as well. Thank you very much.
The member of... Okay. I wanted to take the opportunity to perhaps allow each of you 2 minutes, to perhaps just give us a couple of, to say, say something for these 2 minutes. Give us your thoughts on any of the matters, especially insofar as it relates to this issue and how you suggest, or what you suggest Parliament could do on its part. Now, you will not be, I know the very first thing Ambassador Friend would be saying, no, we can't tell Parliament what to do. and you'll be right when you say that. However, we are not averse to ideas in helping the process along. After all, in the final analysis, we aim to create a better South Africa, a better Africa, and a better world. And we can only achieve that through working together. And so we would like, we would welcome, you know, comments about where you think we could put, as a parliament, put our shoulders to the wind and help the process along. Now, may I add, in your case, particularly Ambassador, it's very rare that you get that opportunity to suggest to Parliament what you do. This is that opportunity to do so. And the same for you, Excellency and Mr. SG. We have, perhaps let me leave that for when I close the meeting. So where shall we start? Let's start with you, Mr. Matlak.
No, thank you very much, Chair. I mean, as we said, as a friend of Cuba Society, this is a very exciting moment for us. We think the continued mobilization of progressive ideas, values and ethos in our society and country will continue to enhance our democratization and transformation process. And therefore, our continued relations with Cuba, addressed by a people-to-people relation, is very key. And as progressives in the country, we have gone to the streets, mobilized people, etc., including the ruling African National Congress, to consider a motion in Parliament that supports the very important key programs that will support the Cuban cause and the Cuban revolution itself. So for us, one of the things that we think could assist us in this direction is that motion in Parliament for the release of the five and for the ending of the blockade. These are key important issues, and as we have, all of us tried to demonstrate, you know, the impediments for Cuba's economic growth and its realization of its latent potential is held ransom by that platform. And for us, if we can take a look at that, thank you very much, Mr. Alibaba. Bye, thank you.
I'd like to say that even though I was appointed as ambassador last year and that I formalized my designation when I presented my letters to President Zuma in February, it has not been truly until about 12 days ago that I've been able to start my obligations, take care of my obligations for a reason that I can't explain. It's too long to explain here. And it's very encouraging to be able to very, very early in my post here in South Africa to come to Parliament and to address you and speak about Cuba. I don't know if there are many parliaments in the world where, as Cubans and as Cuban embassy, we have the opportunity to speak about a country and to explain our country. And I can assure you that there are not many parliaments where we are going to be willing, as we are here, to speak of domestic issues and explain, maybe foreign policy perhaps, but about domestic issues and with a critical view, as I've tried to do here, of our policies and which are our concerns today. I'm not sure, and I'm sure there are not many parliaments where we would be ready to do that. We do that because of how we treasure our relationship with South Africa and because of our aim in wanting to push it forward. And in addition to that, because we believe that the South African Parliament can help in that direction and can help the government in what we know is also the aim of the government in strengthening our relationship and in trying to translate this very positive political will that we have, this very positive political relationship, into more practical, into more effective economic engagement and more effective cooperation between organizations. That is the reason that encouraged me in coming here, and I can threaten you that if you invite me, I will come again. Thank you.
Chair, 2 minutes. First of all, I'd like to congratulate the chair and the committee for getting a forum and where the heading says to aim at kick-starting the economic processes. I think that's very important. Because if we can do that, you know, it's part of a chain. The culture, the tourism, etc. It's people to people, etc. But we've got to try and shrink this distance. And often we are very privileged in the circles that we move to having been in a situation where we could visit Cuba, etc. But ordinary South African does not know what opportunities there are. So there's also some education that comes into that. And I think part of that is also to carry out the message of the appreciation that we have for Cuba's role, small as it is, relatively speaking, in contributing to those objectives that we set ourselves in the priorities and very practical ones like addressing unemployment, etc. Having said that, I think Parliament Chair has a role to facilitate and help with this understanding. I think that's very important. I think it's also got a role to create that enabling environment in which we can all as a team, promote what we're trying to achieve. And I think at the end, it is important that we also be practical. And I'm using the example now of the health attaché that will soon be departing for Havana. Up to now, I can tell you in the last 2 years, our staff at the embassy in Havana have been dealing day to day, hour to hour, with medical students and their normal problems, and not getting out there to also do other work like economic diplomacy, etc. I can honestly tell you, I take my hat off to the people. You have students that become ill. You've got to try and get them here, etc. It's not that easy. So from a practical point of view, if we also have people that understand the circumstances, that will be very helpful for all of us. And again, as Team South Africa, Health, DTI, all of us, would like to make progress, and hopefully if we get together again, we will be able to say, but maybe on the pharmaceuticals or the chemicals or whatever, there's been progress, because that is what we try to achieve. Thank you very much.
I'm going to use much of your time, honorable members. Thank you first and foremost for your contributions. And your proposals, these will be duly considered. I have always taken the view, and so has the committee, that in order for us to truly be a parliament of the people, we need to engage with organizations of civil society, with individuals, generally our citizens, and get their inputs on matters of national and international importance. And so our invitation what's the name of the government? Friends of Cuba Society is precisely to do that, to inject our citizens' views into this very important sphere of policy making now. Now, we should never forget, honorable members, Parliament is an important sphere of policy making. But distinct from the government, the national executive, we have a broader responsibility, in fact, both a political and a constitutional responsibility to ensure public participation in the work that we do, and to conduct the broadest possible views on any matter for us. This is one such matter. So we thank you, Mr. Madago, for making that contribution through your presence here. We are aware that you have other engagements that you almost didn't do. But thank you for finding your way over here. To His Excellency the Ambassador, thank you so much for those of you who've listened to my speech, the budget address. You would have heard that I made it categorically clear that Cuba is a true friend for our country. It is one of the most reliable allies from back in the day, the dark days of apartheid, up to now. Our country can always rely. In fact, the ambassador, if he could talk a little bit about what happens in the multilateral system, he will tell you the high levels of coordination, of engagement that's taking place between Cubans and South Africans, or at least our representatives in these organizations, and the kind of symbiosis there is in our position, or the harmonization that takes place around adopting common positions and so on. And this is important. I can't agree more with you, Ambassador, when you say that it's one thing to have the political will, but it's another thing to concretize that, you know, and implement a practical program that will give effect, you know, to this political will and good intentions. We know, I'm not going to go into the idiom of good intentions. We know what happens to good intentions, but suffice it to say that amongst the tasks that are in front of us as MPs is to ensure that we strengthen our oversight over, in particular, this economic assistance package program. It is too much of an important program to leave to the executive alone to engage with. Because you see, tomorrow we'll blame them even when they run into these kinds of problems. I mean, I'm sure many of us weren't even aware that this embargo was so deep, you know, in the sense that it didn't even allow for Cubans to buy products that, or to receive products, you know, that were at some point manufactured, or that even as a 10%, you know, a portion of it manufactured in the U.S. or that lineage. In fact, I'm also surprised, actually, that, you know, that it's so technical, you know. It's so technical. And so, but it means for countries that whose orientation, like South Africa now, South Africa's official orientation to Cuba is that of a friend and an ally. Right. Now it is our responsibility as a country to see what it is we can do and how to pursue that program. Lastly, I don't want to rehash what the presenters said. But suffice it to say that we can never forget as a country that we ourselves, in fact, where we are today, is because we are beneficiaries. Now listen to what I'm saying, beneficiaries of international solidarity. We can never underestimate its importance. I had a group, a pressure group, coming to see me a couple of months ago. And their question to me was, but and this was in relation to Palestine, Milof. They say, but you know what is the price that South Africa is prepared to pay for its solidarity? You know what it was about the legal issue? You know, are you prepared to forego some of these trade benefits and Angola and the preferential treatment and so on and so on? Now, which I think at the face of it is a good question. Are you prepared to pay the price? That's essentially what the question is. Are you prepared to pay the price? Now, coming from the African National Congress, my response has to be yes. And I wasn't the greatest when I said that. I was conscious of the fact that You know, people were jailed in a country as far as Belgium. You know, people were thrown into jail in London. And so you can go, you know, whether direct or indirect. I mean, you go to people in Maseru, in Lesotho, died, you know, while supporting us. In Botswana, you know, in Mozambique. And so you can go everywhere in the world. Young people were jailed in Washington, you know, for acts that in support of our struggle. And the irony is that few, very, very few of them, if any, even knew any five South Africans by name. Very few, even knew any five South Africans by name. Yet made those sacrifices. So, which brings me back. In fact, in my own realization, in my own political development, I realized that this thing of Ubuntu, you know, we say this thing, Ubuntu, Ubuntu, but really at the core of it is the fact that our humanity lies in the humanity of others. And through confirming the humanity of others, we are actually confirming our own humanity. And showing solidarity, therefore, is a critical, inextricable component of confirming that humanity of others. Honorable members, thank you so much. We'll engage with the matter and deal with proposals. The meeting is adjourned.